to both speakers. Very, very interesting talks. Different, but there was convergence there, so it was very nice to see. So we can open up the floor to questions. So either mics for questions.
Hi. Thank you, both of you, for presentations. It's a nice closure message, Mr. Kosoy. Thank you for that. My question is for Madame Laurette Dubé. Merci pour votre présentation. I was wondering if you could comment on the... You talked a little bit about how to target the youth for agriculture. I was wondering if you could comment a little bit about how policy can shape and improve youth participation in agriculture and how it can impede it. Just as a national example, here in Canada we have a supply management system or quotas that even though it has a lot of advantages, it limits a lot how much young people can go to agriculture. You have to win the lottery in order to start in dairy production. So if your father has a dairy production but you don't want to do it, you won't be involved in agriculture. So I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that.
It's not all sectors of agriculture that have supply management. I agree with you that whether it's dairy or the few other sectors, that the entry cost is very, very high. And that is a significant frontier. But if you look at at the policy, I would answer your question in two ways. At the policy level, I think that if we are talking about interesting the youth to farming, what interests the youth is very much innovation, entrepreneurship, and so on. So what can we do to facilitate and increase the appeal of the work on the farm? I look at my father was one of those who wanted all of us to go to college and get out of the farm. My three younger brothers came back after. So the notion of kind of understanding better the driver of what motivates the youth and then see whether it is through education, investment, or other aspects of supporting this is important. But the other aspect that I think is even more promising, you look at, I study a lot the millennials, which are kind of the most of you in that age category. And the value and the interest of the youth are not necessarily the high job in finance. And so this notion of looking at farming as a serious professional opportunity, I think is real because it does correspond to a very important shift of value in this, I think it's 18 to 30 years old, the millennial. So you get a shift of value that is much more balanced than the kind of workaholic generation that we were in. But for that, I think that farming has to take a bit more of this this notion of linking the CEO of Equity always tell me, Laurette, bringing the computer at the farm make it more sexy for the young, the young farmer in India. So looking at the, it's not just about the financial barrier. I think that there is other issue that makes me optimistic that there is a very important room for youth. The challenge will be because I'm very much involved with a few organizations that are youth-led and wanting to transform the food system and so on. And it's good, but it's a bit too idealistic and not connected at all with any strategy for scalability and so on. So there is initiatives that are promising there, but it has to be seen as part of the way we create a society where our youths want to choose among professions that are appealing. And I think that the context is such that there should be possibility of reversing this decline that you have been observing.
Good, thank Thank you. Professor Begg?
Hello, it was both of you, it was a very, very interesting talk. Just to give it just a brief background, I teach quite a bit in agriculture and I teach to a lot of different students, and we were always talking about the future of agriculture because this is a major concern. There's a couple of things, at least within Canada, agriculture is not considered a profession. In the high schools, no one talks about going into agriculture. You want to become a doctor, you want to become a lawyer, you want to become a plumber, whatever, but never do you want to become a farmer or do you want to work in agriculture. So I think that there's a real issue there that we don't consider agriculture a profession. It's an inherited profession to some extent. The other thing I think, and also going along with the talk about the millennials, there is a strong interest, at least amongst my students, in this, but correspondingly, there is this sort of, I don't want to generalize because there's quite a few of my students here sitting in the audience, but there is this sort of bit of a fantasy that agriculture doesn't have to be a business. And that when we go to the farms, they're too business-like, they're not. But these people are in this because they're passionate. So I think there's this contrast that, you know, how do we talk about business and agriculture and don't turn people off? And how do we really start considering agriculture a profession at the high school level, at the elementary school level? So I offer it up to both speakers to maybe offer some suggestions.
Yeah, if you allow me, I will start because I completely agree with what you are saying. And to complete the answer to the first question, I think that the education, whether it is high school or after, is a key aspect. Even me from a business school, when I started 10 years ago to work on this food convergence innovation, we hosted very, very successful think tanks on addressing diet-related health challenges. And when I started to think, what is it that we have in the business school about food innovation? That's when it cost me $150. I didn't know where was McDonald's. And business school, we are not, we look at the training as well as the research as completely neglected agriculture or farming. Yes, you study Cargill or you study McDonald's, but this notion of integrating this in a real professional way, not the cute local food system, and I have nothing against local food system, I think they are important, but the point is that if you want to reach the scale and the appeal and so on, it has to be embedded within a broader understanding of how society operates and how profession operates. So I completely agree with you that we need to move beyond the idealistic dream-like of the local small farm to kind of see it is, and it should be, a profession that is considered. But there is, when I was talking about a woman, it's not just access, it's a lot of basic value that we have in society for the last 300 years that we need to change. But if you look at the millennial, they are very promising because it's genuine, this shift of value in where priority is put. So the question is, us as a society, can we react fast enough to capture that potential that is there?
I would like to add my two cents and disagree partially with you. Partially with you. So let me partially disagree with you and say that I believe that there should be place and room and respect for local farmer idealistic type, that agriculture and farming shouldn't be only considered a business. Those who consider it a business should have the possibility of working under those conditions, understanding the limitations of business, because we also have to understand that in agricultural systems there is a limit to profit maximization, which is the biophysical limit of that. Even if you want to improve your profit, there is a component of soil fertility and an ecosystem, a living organism that is needed to be maintained. So in that sense, it's a call for a plural approach rather than a singular approach of business in agriculture. I would say agriculture is agriculture. Some would consider it a business. Other would consider it a cultural must. For instance, I would say that when I spent time in Nicaragua looking at working with farmers, and I asked them, why do you grow maize? Why do you grow corn? It doesn't make any sense for you to grow corn. You're losing money. I was looking at their opportunity cost, their investments in inputs, you know, how much they were getting out. They were losing money. And the light looked at me, it's kind of like, what are you talking about? I am the maize people. This is my culture. If I don't grow it, I lose my culture. So he's not a businessman. He is the expression of a culture. Therefore, I think that we should respect that possibility and allow that possibility to coexist along with a business mentality.
I partially agree and disagree with you. That's good. In the sense that, don't get me wrong, I have full respect for local farming and local food system. That is not at all the case. But 2 points. One, business, and at least the one that we want to foster in this convergence innovation, it's not about over-consumption, over-everything, and profit maximization at all costs. It's about moving toward this convergence between social and economic development, not just at the societal level, but in everything that each one is doing as business or as other actor in society. So that's one part. The other part, though, where I think that if you look at subsistence agriculture, and I completely agree that we are in a pre-commercial condition, and let's bring everything we can to help this. But when you look at the scale that can be reached in terms of going from in a place where the USA, for instance, where you talk to the consumer and everyone is about local and everyone is about healthy food and so on. And still, local food system are still just 4% of the food, that is produced. So when we talk about feeding the world, in a way that is sustainable and that reach, the nutrition and the health goal and everything that we are talking about, I think that there is, more reciprocity, let's say, to have between the subsistence and the commercial, and between the local. It's not the local rural village and the big corporation. In between, there is the whole creating of a societal fabrics where you can get the youth who wants to be part of the farming and so on. So I'm not at all not respecting local, but what I'm saying is that the scale that is needed to go beyond what has been possible so far does require more reciprocity.
I'm glad that we converge.
We converge.
Good. Thank you. Okay. We'll have another question.
I have a question for Professor Kosoi. As I mentioned earlier, I'm a consultant, and I've been working on climate change issues. I fully agree with the intellectual position of Via Campesina. I think it makes a lot of sense culturally and ecologically. But we are going through drastic changes in Southern Africa, for example, with climate. I just talked to a farmer. He says, my father used to do his sowing of maize in August. Now I have to do it in January. And another one says, now I have to grow groundnuts. I've always grew maize since the white men arrived here. Sorry, since the colonials arrived here. He is confused. Now, my question is, how can we cope this confusion, Professor Kosoy? I think, as if I understand your position well, it's a cultural configuration that you proposed to us, which I understand. But now another one is coming up because of the shifts in climate that are very difficult to measure right now.
Tough question.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a good question. But I believe that functioning ecosystems are a key for our survival. Definitely, with increasing climate uncertainty, we will have a huge problems with a stability, in a food stability, that is going to lead to issues of food availability, food access, and so. So I believe that pursuing a single bullet solution under conditions of high uncertainty is but is but killing ourselves. It's but like a driving ourselves against a wall, and it's not going to lead us to any evolutionary advantage. I think that diversity is evolutionary advantage in a for different species. And I think that in diversity of agriculture, it is the future. It is what we are. It is our future, in conditions of high uncertainty. So I don't think that my proposal is at odds with a diverse agricultural landscape, where we do have democratic techniques along with viable viable technologies and co-creation of knowledge at different scales by different actors. And but we need to create the institutional system that would allow us to do that. Because what we have now is an institutional system, a system of incentives that are not favoring that diversity. On the contrary, it's a force of homogenization. So that is my concern. So I agree with you. It is not it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be simple. But if we don't do it now, what's going to happen is even worse.
Yeah. Just to add to this, I think that the notion of institutional forms that are needed different. It is true that 300 years of industrialization have been about homogenization and specialization and so on. And the question is that can we get a much more distributed architecture between the local and the regional and the state and national and global and reach it won't be the same efficiency. We have been threatening the health of the people and the health of the planet with this ever increasing consumption. There has to be a new equilibrium, as you were saying. But within that, the challenge is to see we need to relearn how to create those institutions if we want to have that distributed and yet connected to reach any scale, and that's a real challenge that calls for the best of the discipline to kind of get serious about transdisciplinary thinking.
Thank you. Hugo?
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for the two of you. This is really stimulating, and if you allow a couple of comments and perhaps a too big of a question, but I was tempted to think about a business model that some of us have seen in the developing world, and it brings me anecdotally, if you want, to the example of the lady who's selling avocados in a market in Guatemala City. And one of us comes to her and asks her how much the avocados are. She says, 10 cents. So how many avocados do you have there? And she says, well, I have 100 avocados. All right, that makes, we're in Guatemala, 10 quetzales. It's basically $1.25, right, for all the avocados. And then we say, okay, that's pretty, 10 quetzales for all these avocados. I'll take all of them. And she says, no. And I wonder why. And I ask her, it is 7 a.m. I need all the avocados. I have the money. And I am willing to take all your avocados and you can go home and do something else. Perhaps, you know, just harvest more avocados and bring them to the market. And she says, no, I'm not selling all my avocados to you. So I wonder, and then she says, once you're gone, what do I sell? What do I sell?
That's a good point.
And this is a business model. Because I am one in life of a customer. I come to her because I need 100 avocados. I have a party. I have a barbecue. I'm visiting my home country, Guatemala, where people actually believe not only that maize is the central piece of our culture, the gods made us out of corn dough. That was the only material that worked for the gods. Wood and clay and the other stuff didn't work, just corn. So that's another piece, why they still grow the corn. But the business model of the lady makes sense when she tells me, what do I sell then? Because you come today, and later on, during the day, my other customers come as they do. They get one avocado or two, perhaps four. But if I have no avocados more to sell during the day, I am out of business. So the combination of a farmer trying to make business has different forms in my head. What I'm thinking about the Popol Vuh and the
corn. That was your question, or what?
That was my comment. Would you sell all your avocados? That's my question for you. No, my question is, and this, I think it's a question that we all, going to Kenya, or to Nicaragua, India, to other countries, when
we are there, we cannot hear you. Hello? Hello? We cannot hear you.
Can you hear me now?
No.
It's a long story.
Grab this one. No. You don't need to record it then.
Thank you so much. No, my question, which is too big of a question, I think, is how do we make any kind of business, either at the local level or at the larger level, work within the rules of the current system? Is it possible?
It's an open-ended question.
Yeah, please start.
I may start because that is something that if you look at my flowers at the beginning, this notion of this convergence, of kind of creating, transforming the world through food, start in many ways about addressing the diverse and conflicting aspects that we have. Like in business, typically you look at a person as a consumer. You are a doctor, you look at it as a patient. You are in the environment, you look at it as a citizen and so on. And what you're saying is that businesswoman is not just a businesswoman. She is a human being that has a diversity of important aspects in her decision, and she's giving away to that. And I think that it is, and I am serious when I saying that if we are to reach the scale of change, we need to find a way that making money is not at the cost of everything else, the way it has been for, you know, the way we have created industrialization. So I do happen to believe that to reach any scale in food security, you need business somewhere. But I'm saying that business, modern business, should not be what it had been about profitability and economic growth at all costs. So I don't see, I see a lot of challenge, but there is already a lot of move in this direction, I think.
No.
You have a lot to disagree.
No, actually, I don't disagree, just a bit. Yeah, I think that we need to change the world in order to really put those changes into effect. I don't see the possibility of a stepwise approach to social transformation in our society and maintaining the narrative, basically. I don't see how we can align a GDP-driven economy with an alternative model of agricultural production whose objective is not profit maximization, because its contribution to GDP is going to go down eventually. So I think that, yes, we do require a systemic transformation, but we shouldn't be scared about a systemic transformation. We've been receiving far too many signals now from our planet saying, guys, this is not it. And maintaining the same solutions and hoping for a different outcome, it's a bit delusional. So yes, systemic change.
Thank you. Professor Agarwal?
Thank you very much for both of you. Convergence, evolution. To those things, we can also add on the philosophy of life. I think all this is together in that. Then the title we are looking at is Future of Food Security, Who Will Be Farming and How? So, Laurette, you did present wonderful numbers with respect to India. Yes, today, most of the food comes from 1 hectare or 2 hectare of land. When we look at Canadian situation, we do have fantastic infrastructure. We do produce a lot of different types of food, although we don't consume. Pulse is a good example. Most of the pulse is exported to India, where pulse is a major requirement for Indian condition. Now, the farmer who has kids, they don't want their kids to be on the farm because life is tough. Then in Canadian situation, you did show us the aging of the population is increasing. Now, 7.4 billion world moving towards 9.7. There is an urgent need to meet the demand of food. We are a global village. So there are lots of policy issues that is not well handled in a global approach. We always do the policies country-based. So therefore, there are people who want to be like avocado seller, wants to be there and want to do things. But then there are countries like Canada, Australia, some of the European countries, you have the potential to grow more. From the Canadian context, milk is a good example. Although we have ability to produce more, but we don't because there is quota system and things of that nature. Now, pulses, somehow we got going with pulses, and we have a lot more opportunities to grow more pulses, different types of pulses. So, Indian example, if you take, majority of them, the plant protein is very important. Although it is very important, Indian government, pulses is only a secondary crop. They don't consider, like, rice is the most important part. Sugar cane is important. But the pulses, although it is a very important protein requirement, but they have not paid attention to that secondary crop in that sense. And Canada is very well fitting the gap there. So then the question to answer here is, as we move forward in the next 15 years, so we perhaps, yes, we can reduce the post-harvest losses, all of those things are important, but at the same time we have to create policies wherein we don't have any restriction when you have excellent infrastructure, where you have the ability to grow more food, which perhaps can be shared. And it is needed because the number of people involved in primary production, globally it is decreasing. So it is high time for us to look at in a collective way to come up with, you know, the, it is totally in terms of math. Of course, we do have the philosophical part and the evolutionary part and the climate change. All of these things is coming to the picture. I like the concept of convergence. When we talk about convergence, perhaps we should be brought that up to bring these things, especially both of you are in the social science area. There is contribution that needs to be made both to bring all of these points into focus and see how we can actually decide who will be forming and how we can do it for 2025 to 2030. So I don't really have a question. I have a comment. If you would like to comment on those, I'd like to hear them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would be pleased to comment on this in different way. I completely agree with a lot of what you said. And in fact, one of the unique feature of this convergence innovation approach is to say institutional innovation has to be there very, very much. And this notion of creating an enabling environment, it is policy, institutions, and so on that are very key in reaching any scale and any stability. But the point that I would make, and in developing this, I was very influenced by Elinor Ostrom's work in environment. And Ostrom was always saying, don't wait for the treaty, whatever they are called, that has been discussed every year for the last 20 years. Let's hope that they change, but meanwhile, start doing things now as individuals, as community, as business, and so on. So when we talk about this convergence, is to say, let's move toward changing institution and changing policy, but also build upon the best of what is moving now and try to scale up. That's one point. The second point in terms of the policy, because we have been hosting, we always kind of mix policy, maker, business, development, and so on, and that pulse is always comes up, because pulse is not part of the public distribution, except in some states now are moving toward this, and Modi is making it part of his priority. But to this day, there is very public distribution is about rice and wheat, and pulses is not there. And what everybody is asking, and why not including there, why not subsidizing? And the comment that always comes up from the group is saying, go as far as you can there, but the government should not be your only way to transform. If you create more of this entrepreneurship, innovation, or whatever, so that you get more of the, you keep more of the, more incentive for the farmer to grow pulses, and more farming techniques or cultivars that are increasing the appeal of pulses, but also if you start working and keeping more of the value creation so that you keep more of the income that is generated, I think is important. So, but I completely agree with you that policy institution is needed, but it may not be necessarily the policy of the past that we just want to expand to pulses. That's my comment.
Very quick comment. Yeah, I think that a major issue of our planet is, as you mentioned, we have an increasing population. We have to satisfy food demand. We know that we're producing more than enough to satisfy everyone's diets and nutritional requirements. So it's not about production and increasing production. It's about improving distribution of what is being currently produced, is reducing waste, because the amount of waste generated in the minority world, in our part
of this planet is humongous compared to the majority world. I think that a major element here is the that a growing global population is an expression of the metabolic rift. That divide between how we grow food and how we consume food. There is a complete disconnect, this cognitive dissonance in how consumers understand food is grown and how farmers grow it. And in that cognitive dissonance, I think that that is where we see the expansion of predatory behavior in agricultural production, such as understanding food as a financial commodity to be traded in future markets. That is very dangerous, very dangerous. That is not a game to be played, the same as the nature stock exchange that it's being portrayed now from from the UK and showing that, well, that's a great idea. Wait a second, are we talking about financialization of life-supporting systems? Let's be very careful with what we're talking about there. So I consider that in closing the metabolic rift, what is vital is bringing a production and consumption together. Yeah. When we know what we consume, when we know how it's being produced, we understand that our needs are a bit, can fall completely out of any biophysical boundaries and moral boundaries. You know, when you see in the conditions of how many of our food commodities are being produced, you wonder, wow, I'm partially responsible for exploitation of other human beings. I'm partially responsible for the exploitation of nature beyond repair. I'm not a consumer going to a supermarket looking at food products on a shelf without knowing their relationships, social relationships and natural relationships. So it's in a closing that metabolic rift. It is in understanding commodity fetishism that we will overcome not only a problem of feeding the world, but also a population issue, because that is a negative feedback loop that is currently absent, completely absent, in our societies.
Thank you. Michael?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Professor Dubé raised an issue that which I found very interesting when she talked about the rural-urban continuum in the face of food production. And Professor Kosoy ended very nicely with the statement that peasant agriculture feeds the world. Every data is pointing to this fact, and I think we cannot agree more that it's what's happening. But our current food systems kind of is getting all our resources, or all of carbon, is getting from taken away from the rural areas and feeding the population which is concentrated in the urban areas. And that the trend is showing that as the world population continues to grow, urbanization is increasing. So we have fewer and fewer people producing in the rural areas, but at the same time, a lot of the nutrients are being transported and deposited in the rural, in the urban areas. So my question is, how do you see the future of food security and nutrition security, both in the urban areas and in the rural areas, given this large-scale nutrient and carbon mining? Thank you.
You want to start?
Well, yeah, I think that that is precisely the concept of metabolic rift. So basically, one part of the concept of metabolic rift, it's about this closing this nutrient gap between the rural and the urban, this increasing gap, you know, and basically how do we do it? We need to bring those systems together. If I'm not wrong, Patrick Hittes in the 20s talked about a structuring of urban-rural that was disrupting this urban-rural divide, showing it from like a circles of urbanization and production. Of course, we know that that cannot happen at the scales that we have, but we also have to understand that the scale of our urban projects, it's beyond any any comprehension. We cannot have cities as Mexico City with 20, 25 million people living in one place, 40 million living in one place. We have to understand that, yeah, maybe that's a trend, but we have to understand that we have to try to reverse that trend. And I think that your work talks about reversing that trend.
Yeah, in fact, two findings by colleagues, one who is from the Santa Fe Institute, bringing complexity science to study urbanization. And if you look at a multidimensional efficiency aspects, the big metropolis are not at all the most efficient. There is much smaller scale that can be very much more efficient from economy, from everything. That's one part. The second part is that from a solution perspective, and I think it applies both in industrialized as well as in emerging economies, is that as we keep agriculture, if we are keeping agriculture as a driver of economic growth as we grow a country, it has to be in a new model where you build agriculture at the rural level, but progressively you build a whole economic fabrics to support that agriculture. And then you, what you are doing is that you don't have the small village and the big metropole where you go to make money and send the money for the family. You are basically progressively creating much more viable and resilient progression between the rural villages, the midtown in the region, and so on. And a colleague, Thomas Reardon, who originally studied supermarkets and what it has been for good and bad in nutrition when they penetrated the emerging markets. And now Tom is studying what is happening in those areas that have been, he has done work in Africa as well as in India. You get pockets where you get a rural economy that is much more vibrant than in other parts of the country. And he called this the quiet revolution, so that you build capacity not just at the farm, but capacity also for entrepreneurship and innovation in what support the farm first, and create market around, whether it is processing or other. But when you do that, you also have the need for creating a human and economic fabrics for the development. So you are a much more of a continuum from the local villages to the small town to the larger city and so on. And it is in the discussion we have been having on Ethiopia, when they talk about keeping agriculture as a driver of their economic growth as they open, that is a core aspect, is that it should not be the local village and the metropolitan. And there are already countries that are moving in this direction in important ways.
Good, thank you. We've come to the end of our session, so I would like to say thank you for the audience for the great questions, and thank you very much to the panelists for great food for thought and stimulating discussions. Thank you.